content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Joe Caird is titled, What It's Like Trying to Adopt a Child During the Coronavirus Pandemic. Adopting a child is an emotional experience, even in the best of times. Factor in a global pandemic that has led to travel bans, court closings, and stay-at-home orders, and an intense time becomes uniquely stressful for couples hoping to expand their families. While babies don't stop being born just because there's a virus out there, and vulnerable children in the child welfare system don't stop needing the love of a new family, delays throughout the adoption process have meant that adoptive families and children alike have been left in limbo. And those who have been able to welcome children into their homes are struggling to navigate their new lives together in unprecedented circumstances. Just over 110,000 adoptions take place in the United States each year, according to the National Council for Adoption, a nonprofit based just outside Washington, D.C. That's around 9,000 per month, which means we'd be looking at almost 27,000 since the COVID-19 crisis prompted lawmakers across the country to announce lockdowns starting in March. In fact, while the actual number is unknown at this stage, it is certainly much lower than in previous years. This global pandemic will clearly reduce the number of adoptions, says Becky Fawcett, president of HelpUsAdopt.org, a national grant program that helps parents with the costs of adoptions. Between the travel ban and the personal financial crisis some families are experiencing, I can't begin to imagine the full impact this will have. 9 families took time out from the hard work of parenting in quarantine to share their stories about the challenges and unexpected joys of adopting during COVID-19, from the heartbreak of not knowing when you'll be able to bring your little one home, to the joy of courtroom selfies and Skype celebrations commemorating a brand new family. For domestic adoptions, court closings and work stoppages are causing delays. Twyla, 34, a physical therapist in Tennessee, and her husband Roger, 36, who works for a playground company, brought baby Nancy home from the hospital in September 2019. But they hadn't quite finished the formalities of adoption when COVID hit, and their agency was holding legal guardianship of Nancy until everything was lined up. We had been wanting to finalize to make sure she's officially ours, says Twyla. The couple were finally ready, having raised the money to cover the remaining adoption fees, when, she says, everything started shutting down. When the COVID-19 crisis erupted, the process of finalizing Nancy's adoption was hit with delays as courthouses closed and non-essential workers were sent home. Our family wasn't 100% legal yet, and with the added stress of what was going on with the virus, that was really scary, she says. To the couple's great relief, they were eventually given a court date, and Nancy was officially adopted on May 6th. With officials and family members in attendance via video conference, the occasion wasn't the in-person celebration that Twyla and Roger had hoped for, but they do have a unique souvenir, a courtroom selfie sent to them by a presiding judge. Twyla and Roger are among the lucky ones. For plenty of prospective adoptive parents, the pandemic has meant pressing pause on the domestic adoption process, with no way of knowing when they might be able to bring their children home. Robin, 58, a professional organizer in Los Angeles, is coming to terms with an indefinite delay to her adoption proceedings. All of my paperwork was completed, and I was ready for my in-home visit by the county, and then COVID hit, she explains. A single mom to a 15-year-old daughter, Robin is hoping to adopt another 15-year-old girl she met through the charity KidSave, which connects children aged 9 to 18 with families wishing to mentor, host, or adopt. At this time, the county is not doing any in-person visits or virtual visits, so I just wait, she says. It's disappointing. It seems very unfortunate that they're not moving forward in getting kids into permanent homes if that's what they want. Life doesn't just stop because we're doing stay-at-home. International travel bans are keeping children from their families, with potentially heartbreaking results. While court closures have stalled domestic adoptions, and a rash of job losses may mean that some families can no longer adopt, closed borders and travel restrictions are complicating international adoptions. Sarah Jo Floyd and her husband Michael, both 35, live in rural Kansas with their daughters Camden 7 and Avonlea 5. The couple, an artist and warehouse worker respectively, were due to travel to India this spring to collect 16-month-old Elliot from an orphanage in a major city there. Given the international travel ban and the fact that India is currently in full lockdown, those plans have had to be postponed. I was devastated. It just feels very uncertain, says Sarah Jo, who is particularly worried about Elliot because the toddler faces severe health challenges, including the fact that she is blind. The Floyds' concern for their adoptive daughter, with whom the family was matched in January, is more than justified, according to Becky Fawcett of HelpUsAdopt.org. Parents not being able to travel to reach their adoptive children abroad is a major issue, she points out. Some of the kids who are medically fragile will most likely not survive, and some will age out of the system before their families can get to them. Even couples whose international adoptions are well underway face complications. Gina Poirer and her husband Mark, both 36 from Illinois, have just been given a court date to finalize their adoption of a 2-year-old girl in Bulgaria. After the court date, we should receive an official decree a couple of weeks later, at which point we can hypothetically book travel to go pick her up and bring her home, says Gina. Whether or not that can happen is still very much up in the air, however. We're waiting for the EU to open completely and for the U.S. Department of State to lower its threat level for international travel, she explains. There are still a lot of questions, like whether we'll have to quarantine when we arrive in Bulgaria, and what that will even look like. What other restrictions will be in place? What if we get sick while traveling? Will there be any other delays processing her immigration? Given the unknowns, all prospective parents can do is wait and hope. Sarah Jo is looking to daughters Camden and Avonlea for inspiration in terms of staying positive. She says, just seeing their faith and how calm about this they are has really helped me. There are some virtual solutions, but while some are positive, others are not. The unexpected roadblocks facing adoptions have led to workarounds and even a few bright spots. In the normal course of things during their domestic adoption, New York-based Eric Impsch, 34, a graphic designer and art director for Disney on Broadway, and Alan Lane, 34, a fundraiser for the Metropolitan Opera, would have had just one in-person meeting with their baby's birth mother. Instead, says Lane, doing it all digitally meant we were able to meet with her 3 different times and really develop our relationship, to the point where I think we're much closer now. That was an unexpected plus to quarantine precautions, but there were definitely downsides to adopting in the midst of a pandemic. On May 8th, the couple took custody of 2-day-old Margot directly from her birth mother outside the hospital, with social distancing measures in full force. To have to add those very impersonal barriers, both the distance and the masks, made it really challenging to balance the moment, says Lane. It's a celebration for us, and it's a loss for the birth mother. So to add the element that we can't console her or hug her to show our gratitude and support was a real challenge. The good news for new families? Extra time together. For the couples whose adoptions have gone ahead despite the challenging circumstances, bringing their child home has meant sheltering in place as a new family. Novelist James Suriano, 45, and his air traffic controller husband Garen Wade, 34, brought 2-year-old Emmanuel home from South Africa in March, just one day before the cancellation of all flights from South Africa to the U.S. With numbers of COVID-19 cases in South Africa very low at that stage, the couple were shielded from the stress of the pandemic until they got home to Florida. We had no idea how close we were to the edge, says Wade. Staying home nonstop in the 2 months since then has been tough on their older child, now 7, who was looking forward to getting back to normal after 6 weeks in South Africa. But the couple feels quarantine has actually been helpful in terms of settling Emmanuel into life in the U.S. The orphanage that he was in was akin to a single-family home, and he had spent his whole life there, explains Suriano. And now he spends all his time in our home. Kelly Barsarczyk, 38, and Sanjay Santagopan, 41, who have been isolating in Georgia with 4-week-old Isa since picking him up from the hospital parking lot in April, have also appreciated the enforced family time. Working from home together for the month before Isa was born, Bakarzrak, as a program manager for the USDA Forest Service, in Santagopan as a product manager for a software company, gave the couple time to bond. It prepared us for parenthood a little bit in that it was just our little family together all the time. And for Virginia-based Alexander Schrader, 32, and husband Sam, 43, life as a family of six, their children Cameron, 14, Carson, 12, and Joanna, 8, were joined by 12-year-old Jim in September 2019, has certainly been full-on in quarantine. But, Alexander says, the silver lining is that we've all had more time to connect with Jim, talking with him one-on-one. Playing games has been a really great way to be talking, but not have it be a pressure-filled conversation. Still, there are losses. One source of regret for Jim and his new family is that due to COVID-19, they have had to cancel a trip planned to coincide with the finalization of his adoption in Ohio. Jim is really excited that the court date will take place over Skype, allowing the family to seal the books and move forward, says his new mom. But both of them mourn the fact that they won't be able to have a proper celebration of the milestone, bringing together important people from both parts of Jim's life. Still, many parents are pushing forward to make their new families happen. Despite the delays and disappointments, many families are finding ways to work through complicated logistics. Kate, 37, the president of a real estate company, and her government contractor husband Sam, 38, were matched with a birth mother in Kansas in February. Based in Virginia, they were going to leave their boys, 8 and 7, with their grandparents when they flew out for the birth of their adoptive daughter in June, an arrangement they canceled as a precaution once everyone began sheltering in place so as not to expose his parents to any risk. COVID has certainly changed our plans, says Kate, sounding remarkably relaxed about their new setup. Spending up to 2 weeks sheltering in place in a Kansas Airbnb as a new family of five while they await sign-off from the courts allowing them to leave the state with their daughter. But we're very focused on our goals and willing to do whatever we have to do to make it work, she adds. We are so excited to start this adventure, meet our baby girl, and complete our family. Our next article by Jenny Graves is titled, The One Thing Caregivers Tend to Neglect. Joanna Krause and James Gist, who have two daughters under 8, were avid mountain bikers, campers, and hikers when, in April 2016, Gist, a software developer, noticed he was losing grip strength in his left hand. An MRI revealed a congenital tumor in his spine. The family hoped that removing it would get him back to normal. But following surgery in December, his hand felt even worse, and then he started having trouble walking. Over the next year, as Gist became progressively weaker and sicker, he needed his wife's assistance with dressing, bathing, and getting around. I was working full-time, taking care of the girls in the house, and calling doctor after doctor to try to figure out what was happening with my husband, recalls Krause, 45, a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Fort Collins, Colorado. I was barely keeping it all together. I snapped at the girls, I snapped at James. I would get this feeling that my vision was narrowing, like when you stand up too quickly and blackness starts coming in from the sides. A year after his spinal surgery, Gist was diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. This degenerative illness affects the motor neurons that control voluntary muscles, slowly eroding the ability to walk, speak, swallow, and eventually breathe. We went from the terrifying unknown to a grief-filled reality, says Krause, but having a diagnosis at least gave us a path forward. The ALS Association connected Krause with caregiver support groups and helped her figure out ways to make their home more accessible, like installing an elevator. Gist was put on palliative care, and a certified nursing assistant visited regularly. The help was wonderful, Krause says, but just as we'd start to feel on top of things, something new would happen. For example, James would no longer be able to feed himself, or he'd develop pneumonia. Then the curveball, that was COVID-19. To protect her husband, Krause focused on avoiding germs and people. The idea that our behavior could endanger his life was never far from my mind, she says. When our kids' school shut down, Krause added managing learning to her daily chores, which already included ordering medical supplies, attending online doctor appointments, and assisting Gist, who requires 45 minutes of help just to go to the bathroom. For 4 years, Krause has felt pulled in a million directions. I can't do enough for my kids to make up for the partial loss of a parent. I can't be present for my husband the way he wants me to be. She hasn't been able to work as much as she'd like or do the stress-relieving outdoor activities she and her family used to enjoy. I feel awful for James, she says. None of this is his fault, but that doesn't make it any easier. In the U.S., there are an estimated 53 million caregivers like Krause, people who, in the past year, have been helping an adult, including an elderly parent, or child with special needs. 61% of caregivers are women, according to the 2020 Caregiving in the U.S. report from AARP and the National Alliance for Caregiving. Their average age is 49, and many provide care for 4 years or more. That's a long time, considering caregivers spend, on average, 24 hours a week doing things for recipients, on top of everything going on in their own busy lives, says C. Grace Whiting, president and CEO of NAC. Even before the economic downturn, one in five caregivers reported high levels of financial strain as a result of their duties, and many struggle with debt. Unsurprisingly, caregivers are at increased risk for a host of health problems: depression, anxiety, arthritis, headaches, diabetes, back pain, weakened immunity, and even cancer. They seldom have time or energy to focus on their own well-being. If they're able to take a break, they may struggle with guilt. And 21% say they feel alone, even if they live with the person they're caring for, though social distancing during the pandemic may have boosted that figure even higher, says Whiting. The isolation, unpredictability, stress, fear, grief, and guilt are bound to take a toll. And when your well-being suffers, so does that of the person you're caring for, says Amy Goyer, AARP's family and caregiving expert, and the author of Juggling Life, Work, and Caregiving. When you're tending to yourself, you function more effectively and are far more equipped to handle the emotional and physical demands of tending to someone else. If you're providing unpaid help to a loved one, whether you've been doing it for years or you started during the coronavirus outbreak, it's crucial to make sure you're not neglecting your own mental and emotional health. Here are 8 ways to look after yourself. Accept the role. Claiming the ID of caregiver is like earning a new title at work. It validates the extra responsibilities you're taking on, says Goyer. Owning your position is especially important if you were unexpectedly thrust into it, as many of us are. Ownership gives you a sense of control, which can help reduce stress, she says. Redefine success. Setbacks are inevitable, so it's important to think realistically about what you can achieve. You likely can't prevent gradual deterioration, accidents, or symptom flare-ups, or aging in general. I took care of both my parents as they got older, and if my mom fell or I couldn't make my dad better, I felt like a failure. That mindset didn't help any of us, says Goyer. I realized that a better benchmark of success was simply not giving up. I knew I could do that, and it made me feel good to acknowledge that by showing up and doing the hard work, I was succeeding. Don't dwell too much on the negative. Training yourself to see the good things, whether it's a pleasant interaction with your elderly mom or the flowering tree outside her window, can help balance the emotional scales, says Liz O'Donnell, founder of Working Daughter, an online community for women caregivers. She suggests setting a timer for 5 minutes at the end of the day, writing down things you're grateful for or that you did well, and then reflecting on how that makes you feel. Research shows that finding the positives, especially during difficult times, can enhance well-being, enrich relationships, reduce depression, and improve sleep. Not a journaler? Visit the Greater Good Science Center's thanksfor.org to register for a gratitude challenge that sends you friendly daily reminders to count your blessings. Look forward. Think about what you want your life to be like when you're done caregiving, suggests O'Donnell. When her parents were both diagnosed with terminal illnesses on the same day, she initially felt obligated to give her entire life over to them. Then I realized that my happiness depended on maintaining a loving daily connection with my husband and kids and keeping my job. So I talked with my family about my caregiving responsibilities and how we could make the situation work for all of us, and I asked my boss about adjusting my availability. The juggle was still a challenge, but maintaining the things that mattered to me made my life feel more balanced. You have the right and the responsibility to grow, learn, and fashion a better future for yourself. Create a sanctuary. Whether or not you share a living space, too much togetherness with the person you're caring for can make it feel like the walls are closing in. You may need to get creative in finding a metaphorical room of your own. You could plant an indoor or outdoor garden, or designate a corner of your house for hobbies or catching up with friends. If you use that space exclusively to let go of stress, you'll begin to connect it with a feeling of relaxation and get a quick hit of ease just by stopping by. You can also take advantage of the time when your loved one is sleeping or being tended to by someone else to disappear into a book or a movie, or even a vacation via Airbnb's online experiences, where you can, say, learn about bees from a Portuguese beekeeper. Brief escapes to another world can be surprisingly refreshing, says Goyer. Meet your grief. Caregivers are often in the process of losing someone they love, and that sadness adds to the emotional burden, says O'Donnell. What's more, the pandemic has amplified that sense of loss because we're all grieving for the way our lives used to be. By using self-compassion, you can ease your way through sorrow and find comfort at the same time, says Kristen Neff, PhD, an associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. She suggests this brief meditation for recognizing and getting through hard times. In a quiet moment, sit and think about your grief. Feel the emotion in your body. Say to yourself, "This is really hard right now, but grieving is a part of being human." Put your hands over your heart and say, "May I care for and comfort myself in this moment," or "May I hold my grief with love." Then just breathe. Acknowledge when you're not okay. It's normal to feel anger and frustration over the fact that your life isn't what you thought it would be, says Whiting. Try to find healthy ways to cope, since research suggests that overtaxed caregivers can be at greater risk for problematic alcohol use and weight gain. Krauss has learned to rely on psychotherapy sessions and support groups. "I love being able to talk things out with people who understand what I'm going through," she says. Recognize signs of depletion. Red flags include losing your temper, feeling run down, and fantasizing about escape. Use them as your cue to do something that fills you up, even if it's as simple as playing with your dog. Some pick-me-ups, such as working out, require planning, so ask a family member, friend, or neighbor to help out. Having scheduled relief gives you something to look forward to. During more existential crises, try to remind yourself of your deeper values. The Pew Research Center found that caregivers age 45 to 59 considered 53% of their caregiving activities to be very meaningful. When you're personally struggling, thinking about the significance of the work you're doing can infuse it with a sense of purpose and help you feel proud of your efforts now and in the future, no matter what happens. Our next article, by Chris Azzopardi, is titled "Francois Clemens on What Has and Hasn't Changed Since Making History on Mr. Rogers." On an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in 1969, Mr. Rogers famously asked Francois Clemens, one of the first recurring black characters on a kids' TV series, to soak his feet in a foot bath with him on a hot day. It was an invitation for Clemens, but also for all Americans to stand in solidarity with the black community. Through 1993, Clemens was featured in 98 episodes of the iconic children's show. He came to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in 1968 amid a civil rights movement that eventually led to a symbolic show of black allyship from its beloved series namesake, Fred Rogers. Racial tensions were high. Recreational segregation was widely enforced. Clemens retired in 2013 after 15 years as Middlebury College's artist-in-residence and director of its Martin Luther King Spiritual Choir. Now 75 years old, he says he is still asked about Mr. Rogers whenever the world is in crisis. "People are always saying, 'What would Mr. Rogers do?'" Clemens told OprahMag.com, reflecting on the image now As the country again is confronted with a racial reckoning that has galvanized Black Lives Matter protests and marches around the world, you should be saying, what should we be doing, you and me? This is our time. Fred had his time. In May, when ex-cop Derek Chauvin pressed his knee on George Floyd's neck for a stomach-turning 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the vintage snapshot of Clemens and Rogers began to make the rounds again. It flooded social media feeds as a statement of what America could be and inspired many reflections on the photo's enduring relevance. Floyd was murdered just weeks after Clemens' memoir was published on May 5th. With that same iconic pool scene as its cover photo, Clemens' book personalizes the experiences of racism and homosexuality during the 1960s civil rights movement, chronicling his own harrowing youth as a Black, then-closeted gay man growing up in Birmingham, Alabama. There, he was raised in a violent home environment with a neglectful mother, an abusive father, and a stepfather who didn't accept him being gay. He found his joy in singing and went on to become a trained Grammy-winning opera singer. It was his voice that ultimately captivated Rogers. After hearing Clemens croon some of his favorite spirituals at a Presbyterian church in Pittsburgh on Good Friday in 1968, Rogers was so moved he asked Clemens to be the officer on Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. The two would forge a lifelong friendship. In 2018, during our first conversation, Clemens referred to Rogers as his surrogate father. But he was still shocked by Rogers' offer. He wondered, why would a white man ask a Black man to play the kind of man Black people fear? He ended up turning down the role until Rogers convinced him otherwise. Frank, people are going to look up to you for singing that way and going around the neighborhood being a part of the community, Clemens recalls Roger telling him. That is going to change a lot of people's opinions about policemen. I swear to you, Frank. Clemens' initial hesitancy was the result of dreading even a passing encounter with the police as a young boy in Birmingham, where he observed far more white cops than Black cops. Growing up, aunts and uncles, but also everybody, taught him how to behave in the presence of a policeman. Don't look straight at them. If they come, lower your eyes. Keep walking. Don't walk fast. And don't say anything. As the Black Lives Matter movement marches on, Clemens is reminded of his heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rogers, who died in 2003. He also admires the movement's Black women leaders, including BLM co-founders Patrice Kahn-Coolers and Alicia Garza, who are spearheading today's fight for racial justice in a similar manner to that of Rogers, because they call on a moral law and they practice that. He says the message Rogers was sending in 1969 is much like the one being sent currently. You cannot treat your neighbor like that. In Officer Clemens, he recounts an encounter with a racist conductor who demanded he get off my stage while his neighborhood co-stars prepared for a show at the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Emotionally distraught, Clemens explained the situation to Rogers, who provided the kind of protective safety and comfort Clemens could count on. In his book, Clemens recalls Rogers confronting the conductor, speaking calmly but with intent. He writes that Rogers said, "In our neighborhood, we don't talk like that, and especially to one of our neighbors." An apology was demanded. If one could not be given, he told the conductor there would be no show. As he reflects on Rogers' loyal allyship to him during that incident in the 1970s, Clemens stresses that now the same kind of committed support needs to be given to vulnerable Black transgender communities from white gay America, as the latter demographic, he says, have achieved a certain kind of social acceptability. You have an obligation to your Black sister and your Black brother and your trans sister and your trans brother, he says. You can't just walk away. If white people are silent, we cannot win this battle. Even though this is our battle to fight, if Rogers was to tell you what to do, he'd tell you get out and help in any way that you can, Clemens says. You do not have to go out on the front lines and get a gun and use it in order to be helpful, but you do have to help people change the minds of those who are dedicated to hurting Black people. Part of his own contribution, Clemens says, is his memoir. He hopes his resilient life story will serve as a model of perseverance for those being condemned for who they are like he once was, particularly in the Black queer community. When he was a boy, he had no one to tell him this, and so with this book, I wanted to be able to say to them, your life is valid. Now that his story has been told in his own words after decades of working toward its publication, Clemens still has more to accomplish. One achievement, he says, was realized with this very story. To see his name appear under the O, the Oprah magazine title, has long been a dream. And he's up late every night writing another book. For it, he says, I meditate and have almost an out-of-body experience, and I go away with him, referring to his enduring spiritual bond with Rogers. He writes at his Vermont home where he's been in pandemic isolation with his Tibetan terrier Princess. There he greets friends from his porch at a safe distance and reads the fan mail that is still sent to him in steady streams. He humbly writes back to his admirers, many of whom are real-life black cops, who felt they could effect change like Clemens did as a groundbreaking fictional one. With a graciousness that still moves and surprises Clemens decades after dipping his brown feet in a bath with Roger's white feet, they write to him with a shared sentiment, gratitude. I'm amazed that something I did 50 years ago still resonates in the breadth of the nation, he says warmly. I mean, people know what I did, and they talk about it. Everywhere I go, they talk about it. Our next article by Alina Nicolou is titled, What Happened to Unsolved Mysteries, Christopher Dansby and Shane Walker? Stolen Kids, the final episode of Season 2 of Unsolved Mysteries, is one of the Netflix series' bleakest. The episode links two child abductions that took place at the same Manhattan playground in 1989. Two mothers grapple with the knowledge that their sons, Christopher Dansby and Shane Walker, are gone, possibly forever. It's like a nightmare, and every day you wake up and you're still in the nightmare. Some days I just don't want to go on, Allison Dansby, who was 26 when her son disappeared, told Pix 11 in 2014. She elaborated on her harrowing experiences in the Unsolved Mysteries episode. Similar to all Unsolved Mysteries episodes, whether about murder or suspects on the lam, the cases explored have no resolution. However, that also means Dansby and Walker, gone for over 30 years, could still turn up. We don't have bodies. We have two missing kids. You gotta believe that maybe they survived, Ken Lindell, a retired inspector for the New York Police Department, said in the Unsolved Mysteries episode. Here's what we know about the circumstances of the children's disappearances. The boys' disappearances occurred a few months apart in the same Harlem park. The cases have striking, eerie similarities. The victims lived in the same apartment. Their disappearances took place on the same day of the week and around the same time of day. Most disconcerting? Both stories involve the appearance of the same brother and sister duo. On May 18, 1989, 26-year-old Allison Dansby took her 2-year-old son Christopher, called Choo Choo by his family, to the playground at the Martin Luther King Jr. Towers housing project. Around 7 p.m., Allison left Choo Choo with her mother and friends while she made a quick errand to the store. By the time Allison returned, her son had vanished. Dansby had been seen playing with a 10-year-old girl and 6-year-old boy right before he disappeared, as was Walker on August 10, 1989, while visiting the same park with his mom, Rosa Glover. Glover recalls that the brother and sister insisted on playing with Walker. She reluctantly agreed. Glover was briefly distracted by a man who sat down next to her. When she looked up, her son was gone, and she saw the two kids running on the other side of the fence. They said, "We left him in the park," she recalled, "but he wasn't in the park. He was gone." According to Lindell, the siblings and their parents were interviewed by NYPD at length. There was a belief that they had acted as decoys and somebody stole a kid, Lindell said in the episode. However, he also said there was no indication that they were involved in Walker's disappearance. Their identities have never been released. Some believe Dansby and Walker were taken by a child-stealing ring. After the boys' disappearances, extensive searches were conducted of the area, and the parents' phones were tapped. However, no leads emerged. Rumors about their fates flooded the Harlem community and news coverage. Most prevalent was the unfounded but persistent idea that Dansby and Walker were taken for an adoption ring, which was even cited in the New York Times at the time. I think they were probably taken by people who couldn't have children, people who were desperate to have a baby, Mary Murphy, a reporter for WPIX-TV, said during the episode. Glover agreed, saying, I think what happened, those two kids took him out there. Whoever had him took him away. There's hope that Dansby and Walker will be found, like Carlina White was. According to the FBI, as of 2019, juveniles under the age of 18 account for 30,618 active missing person cases, or 35% of all cases, each representing another unsolved mystery. At the end of the episode, Stolen Children presents the story of Carlina White, who was eventually reunited with her family after her abduction, as a hopeful scenario. At 19 days old, White was taken from a Harlem hospital by a woman posing as a nurse. White was raised by her abductor, Ann Petaway, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, under the name Nejdra Nettie Nance. 23 years later, White became pregnant with her daughter and needed her birth certificate. She learned it had been forged, adding to her suspicions about the woman who raised her. She said she just had a feeling. She felt different from the people raising her, Carlina White's maternal grandmother, Elizabeth White, told the Associated Press, per ABC. Eventually, White solved her own missing persons case. She noticed her daughter, Samani, looked like her own baby photo on the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. According to ABC, she called the center's hotline and said, I don't know who I am. White reunited with her biological parents, Joy White and Carl Tyson, and that's where the Unsolved Mysteries episode concludes her story. However, a New York Magazine deep dive exposes how complicated a reunion is under these emotional circumstances. Not long after reuniting, White's relationship with her biological parents deteriorated. She learned they had spent the $424,000 set aside for her through a 1992 settlement with Harlem Hospital. The trust fund was hers if she was found by the age of 21, which she hadn't been. It's gone, Joanne White said on the Today Show in 2011, per the CT Post. We both had to live. We put that money up for her ourselves, and at the time, things were really rocky for me as far as a living situation and stuff like that. And I have two other kids, a son and a daughter, and I had to take care of myself. I had to live. Speaking to New York Magazine, White said their argument had nothing to do with money. Rather, she felt betrayed that Joy White would make those allegations on TV and not to her directly. How dare you go on TV and say something like that? I never asked y'all for anything, White recalls of the conversation that ensued after Joy's Today interview. White's experience inspired a Lifetime movie in 2012 with Sherry Shepherd and Ajahnue Ellis playing White's biological mother and kidnapper. Kiki Palmer played White. As of 2018, it appears that White's relationship with Joy has been repaired. She posted an Instagram photo of them together with the caption, My Lovely Mother. The case is also similar to Kamaya Mobley. The recent story of Kamaya Mobley, also the subject of a Lifetime movie, offers another angle at a reunion. Mobley was just hours old when she was taken from a hospital in Jacksonville, Florida. She was raised by her kidnapper, Gloria Williams, who told Mobley the truth of her identity when she was 16. Demonstrating the complexity of the situation, Mobley decided not to speak out. At 18, Mobley finally reconnected with her biological family. Now 22, Mobley remains close with her father and siblings. As of 2019, Mobley has a rocky relationship with her biological mother, Shanara Mobley, because she still keeps in touch with Williams, who is serving out an 18-year prison sentence. Mobley's father, Craig Aiken, hopes to one day meet the woman who stole his daughter, the woman she still calls Mom. I just want to know about my daughter, and if that's taking me to talk to the enemy, that's what I would do to build a relationship with my daughter, Aiken told a Jacksonville news station in 2020. As the stories of Mobley and White demonstrate, there are no easy endings, even if the mysteries are solved. Our next article by Ariana Davis is titled Kevin Hart on Cancel Culture, his audiobook The Decision, and Baby Number 4. It's hard to imagine when Kevin Hart sleeps. In the past year alone, the entertainer has either starred in, executive produced, or voiced several projects, from Jumanji to The Secret Life of Pets, to a Netflix docuseries about his life, Kevin Hart, Don't Blank This Up. But now the Philadelphia native is gearing up for two big new projects. First, welcoming a baby girl, his fourth child, and the latest addition to his family with wife Aniko Hart. And second, an audiobook, The Decision, the follow-up to his first book, I Can't Make This Up. With his latest release, available on Audible, Hart says he hopes to simply provide information. The one thing that people don't do enough of is sharing information, he says. We all have the ability to be successful, but some people just don't know the road to take to get there. During an interview on Instagram Live, Hart shared with me more of what we can expect from The Decision while dropping some of his signature Kevin Hart wisdom on from everything from cancel culture to why it's important that we all become more open about sharing our secrets to success. On how he's recovering from a serious car accident in September of 2019. I think where I was before the accident, I was in great shape, really taking care of myself. But to get into that accident, be blessed enough to still be here and be a husband and father and friend to so many, I think that I owe myself a service to try to surpass that version of myself. I can do better. That's the kick that I've been on, me versus me. I'm probably at 98%, I'll call it 110% when I feel like it's 110%, and by the summer I should be able to hit my fitness goals and then I'll see what happens after. On what we can expect from his audiobook, The Decision. It's basically information. I feel like in today's time, the one thing that people don't do enough of is sharing their information. We don't volunteer it. There has to be an ask for there to be a tell, and when you think about it, that's one thing that stands in the way of success. The Decision is about taking responsibility for you, your actions, your movements, your decisions. It's ultimately you. What I wanted to do was be transparent with my life, my journey to where I am now, and give you all the decisions that had to take place in doing it. And what you realize is, it's okay to fall, it's okay to not get it right. The thing about making mistakes is embracing it and being willing to grow from it. If you are that person and you are willing to grow from it, you're going to be better off in the long run. If you're not that person, it means that you haven't yet developed the ability to check yourself. So you can look at you and address the things wrong with you so you can fix you. It's about me discussing how I got to that place in life and how I whipped myself in mental shape to deal with all that I've dealt with and to embrace those things rather than wallow in the pity of what I can't change. It's not as if I'm a prophet. It's very simplistic information. But because of my personality, because of where I am in life, I choose to deliver the message in a way that nobody else has or probably can. It's about self-check. I can't continue to blame other people for my shit, and that's what other people enjoy doing. I would have did it, but such and such didn't tell me. Nobody woke me up, so that's why I overslept. It's always about somebody else. So this is a book for you. This isn't a do what I do book. This isn't a live like me. This is about me giving you a different lens to look through, a different POV, so you can assess it and decide if it works for you or not, but at least you have the information. People think it's a cool thing to withhold. You can see someone with cool sneakers. You'll ask, "Where did you get those sneakers?" And they'll say, "I'm not telling you. You got to figure that out on your own." Well, why? What happens if more people have the sneakers? What does that do to you? That analogy can be applied on the highest level, to business. Why can't you just tell me and help me so I can get some information to be successful as well? Information shouldn't be a secret. On social media and cancel culture. You got to get to a point where you become more realistic. What I mean about being realistic is nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to be. We're living in a time where we're just expecting perfect, as if people don't slip and fall down the steps, or everybody walks straight all the time. But you stumble. It's weird to really hold people at a level that they never asked to be held at. If babies came out with all the knowledge, then what's the point of going from age 1 through 21? You get to 21 and there's a celebration of you now being an adult, because you spent those years being a kid, doing the things that a kid is supposed to do. So you can't hold me accountable for things that I did as a kid that were childish behavior at 21 when I'm now an adult. Well, from 21 to 31, I was a young adult, so I didn't know what life is going to be like as an adult, so I messed up as a young adult. We can't be so persistent with the search to find and destroy. Although some things are warranted, and I understand, it's just us as people have got to be smart enough to go, you know what? Whatever has happened has happened, but people deserve a chance to move on. Life isn't over because people say it is, and that's what's been happening as of late. It's like people determine when your end button is pushed, but that's not how it works. We need to lose that attitude and feeling and let people grow. People love to talk shit. People love to be negative, but guess what? They also love to be positive, but we only talk about the negative. On preparing for the arrival of a daughter, his fourth child. I'm going to be part of a family of six. This is not a dynamic I was raised in when I was a little kid in Philadelphia. My parents weren't together. It was just me and my brother was in the army. It's not like I come from a major big family and household. To be creating that and changing the direction of the last name Hart, and my kids having the opportunity to associate family with memories of being together, brothers and sisters, mom, dad, stepmom. There's so many things that go into it, but ultimately it's together. Putting water on it so it grows, then everything I've done so far and have worked hard to have is worth it, because that last name lives on. I want to leave them something in return. Our next article by Alexandra Fuller is titled, This Is Why I'll Never Fly Again. In 2015, my British-born father died of pneumonia while he and my mother were on a rare holiday in Budapest, far from their farm in the middle of Zambezi Valley. I flew from Wyoming to be with him in a ramshackle communist-era ICU room where we sweltered in a heat wave. 3 days before he died, Dad begged me to take him and my mother home to Zambia. I considered renting a van, driving him out of Hungary and across Europe to the Rock of Gibraltar. At least he'd die in sight of the continent on which he'd spent 50 years of his wild, wondrous life, restlessly farming across southern Africa. But even if I didn't kill him getting down the stairs, the elevators were broken, the city roads were clogged with an impenetrable murmur of Syrian, Afghan, and South Sudanese refugees, human grief in motion. I remember thinking, the times we've been warned about are upon us. The rivers of displaced people arriving in Europe from war-ravaged, climate-destroyed parts of the world, lives wrecked, motherlands abandoned, families torn asunder. It felt wrong to insist on laying my dead to rest so far away when there was such unrest among the living right here. I'd been inching towards such an awakening for years. I could travel freely, and I did, but so many refugees are forced to roam due to ecological disasters caused by our rapidly changing environment. Climate change that is aggravated by the devastating harm of an airplane habit like mine. All my adult life, I've traveled for work and love, which for me are mostly the same thing. From my mid-20s, I'd flown yearly at least between Zambia, where my parents had finally settled, and my home in Wyoming, coming and going as if I could afford the carbon, as if the planet could. And I'd flown for work, for magazine articles and book tours, to Angola, Haiti, Mozambique, Namibia, Chile, London, Paris, Rome, Mexico City, New York City, this city, that city. Just typing the names, I can feel the drug of it, adrenaline and awe, the rush of being in unfamiliar places, breath taken by the speed of it all. But the constant motion didn't always feel right, and not just for environmental reasons. It shouldn't be logistically possible to get from the Zambezi River to Wyoming, for example, in less than 2 days, because emotionally it is impossible. The shock is too much, the contrast too raw. Still, I did it. The jet lag hangover, driven by the fear of what would happen if I stopped. Fear of missing out, of work drying up, of becoming irrelevant, of not seeing places and people I love. Returning home after my father's memorial service in Zambia, attended mostly by people who'd never left the river's banks, let alone the country, I decided to follow the advice of every guru ever and be the change. I assessed my carbon footprint to see where I could mend and amend. I had 3 kids and more pets. Plus, I used the web. Studies show the data centers running internet activity produce roughly the same amount of carbon emissions as aviation, each search adding up. I drank tea from India, ate grapes from Chile. If shipping were a country, it would be the Earth's 6th largest polluter. And on top of it all, the flying. I couldn't give up everything, but I knew I had to eliminate something. And because it was easier than undoing the miracle of my 3 children, relinquishing dogs or tea, or quitting Google, I vowed to give up flying. It was a vow I made a 6 times in the 3 years following my father's death. Every environmental disaster would inspire fresh resolve. The polar bears were starving on their melting islands of ice. Australia's Great Barrier Reef was dying. California raged with wildfires. I'd ground myself for 2 months, 6, even 9. Then an editor would call with a story in Ethiopia, South Africa, Madagascar. One last time, I'd vow. Just one more journey. I had excuses. Traveling is how I make stories. Stories are how I make a living. Also, I felt compelled to go as if there were a wanderlust mechanism inside me, like a bird's impulse to migrate. But it was arrogance and ignorance that really kept me airborne. I was 46 when my father died. It was the sadness of a whole lifetime ripening. I thought I'd never know sorrow like it. Then this happened. In early July 2018, my son Phi, the middle of my 3 children, the steady one I worried about the least, died too. Taken by an inexplicable seizure in his sleep in the western Wyoming Valley where he'd been born 22 years earlier. You can't know much in the first searing weeks and months of that kind of grief, just the sparkling white horror. But I knew right away that Phi's death removed illusions for me. Everything wouldn't miraculously work out in the end. I was wide awake and I could no longer lie or deny or equivocate. The comforting excuses we have for our behaviors, those casual hypocrisies, stopped working for me. Mars burned red in the sky the awful long summer that Phi died, and in September, wildfires tore through the Wind River Mountains. Grief is an inferno. It blazed into fall and beyond the first snowstorms in October. I spent Thanksgiving with a friend who had suffered her own recent loss. Our eyes turned upward, watching the moon rise, full and creamy, in a desert indigo sky. When an airplane flew past it, creating an illuminated zero as if to say, no more, a celestial stop sign, I knew my game was up. In mourning, I'd become accustomed to God speaking to me in obvious symbols like this. That's it, I said. I'm done with planes. I need to stay home and plant trees. I was determined to stop flying, to stay put where my son is buried, and to reconcile my body and my inconsolable shadow. I couldn't ignore the toll anymore, the images of mothers holding dead children after floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, disasters caused by a destabilized climate that my own trips upended even further. I knew what it felt like to scream the wrongness of what is into the ears of a deaf universe. I couldn't ignore my contributions to an increasingly uninhabitable planet, already hotter than scientists had predicted 5 years earlier. I couldn't be a part of what would make the world uninhabitable to my surviving children, all surviving children. Even after that, I didn't stop flying right away. I took a few last trips, love miles I deemed worth it, final farewells, a momentous bunch of carefully considered lasts. I went home to Zimbabwe and Zambia to say goodbye to the lands that raised me, to my mother and sister, to the Zambezi River and the miraculous insistence of life along its banks. When I started to turn down work and invitations, refusing to fly, people reacted much as they had years earlier when I'd stopped drinking. One applauded my morality. A few defensively assumed my decision was an indictment of their flying, and more insisted I'd fly again, and many said things like, "We all do what we can." But that isn't true. Most of us do what we can get away with. I know I did. Then the world quarantined to a halt, and the thing that stopped everyone traveling stopped me. On my 3rd week of self-isolation during the pandemic of 2020, as the Antarctic experienced an unprecedented heat wave, I asked myself again, what will it take for me to take root if not this? I vowed again for the last time, no more planes for me. Here was the universal parallel between the vow I kept making and the question we all found ourselves asking. Is this trip worth endangering the people I'm going to see, the community I live in, the world at large? Sitting with my dying father, the flow of refugees in the streets, the Danube boiling, I thought, surely we all need to rest in place, take a breath, ask ourselves what's essential, what isn't. Now I know my answer. I can drive less, use the internet less, write deeper, garden better, read and reread my library. I can plant more trees, compost, reduce, rest. I can be more grounded, less addicted, because I am literally grounded. It's my response to this halted world. So here I stay in the Northern Rockies. Unless by sailboat, then by road or rail, I won't see Mum again, her joyous, ever-replenishing pack of dogs, the farm, the Zambezi, or my sister in her thatched house near the Kafue River. We're not au fait with the quarantine-era technology of video chats. We can send letters, though. It'll be like boarding school, but forever. As I write this on a sunny day in the Rockies, there are chickadees animating the aspens like tiny ascetic monks. We've commented on it, my dairy farmer neighbor and I, the beautiful drama of stillness, about which he knows everything. He has left his farm for only one night in the past 50 years. In our flyover state, there's flying pollution. Now, with air travel down 95%, the skies above us are not besmirched with vapor trails. Days are clear, much like they were in his childhood. It's such an abundance right here, right now. And it's already taken too much for me to see that the more still I become, the more the whole world is mine, all the time, infinitely. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.